The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
You've tuned in to Columbia Calling, your first stop for everything you want to know about Columbia. How and where to invest, where to visit. From the Pacific to the Caribbean, the Andes Mountains to the Amazon jungle, Columbia has a slice of everything. Shooting from the hip, answering the questions that need answering. Here's your host, the journalist and hotelier Richard McCall, shedding some light on the fashionable South American destination of Columbia.
This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McCall. Welcome back. New week, new podcast, episode 144. And we're here today. We'll be talking to Miguel Samper Strauss. Now, Miguel is the son of a former president, Ernesto Samper, who was in power from 1994 to 1998. Miguel himself is a political machine. He has moved into politics himself. He was the vice minister for justice, and he's now the director of the National Land Agency here in Colombia. So it's a very important interview when we think about the spiritual connection between Colombians and the land. And of course, land is one of the causes, one of the principal causes of all the troubles that have taken place in Colombia, dating back before 1964, when official records have the ongoing conflict beginning in Colombia. So we'll be talking all about some quite dense subjects with Miguel Samper, the director of the National Land Agency, in just a few minutes. I want to talk about a few things. And so we're talking about, what can I say? Well, I wanted to talk about our relationship with this travel agency, Columbia for You. That's Columbia for, that's the figure, you.com. We have an agreement with them. If you are coming to Columbia, if you are interested in Columbia, check out columbiaforyou.com. And if you are interested in booking on some of their travel options here, they've got in Bogota, Medellin, Cartagena, Cali, the Caribbean, the Coffee Zone, Santander, Amazon, so covering most of the country, do use the code Columbia Calling for You. For you, of course, in the figure and then the letter for you. So use that, Columbia Calling for You, if you are coming here to Columbia and you are interested in doing some sightseeing and some tours. The Copa America seems to be occupying everybody's thoughts and minds. What more can we say? Colombia scraped through, narrowly scraped through against Peru with some penalties. It was a penalty shootout until Ospina pulled off some heroics, a goalkeeper saving a penalty, and then the following Peruvian player skied the ball way up into row Z, and Colombia are through. So they will be then playing, they will be playing on Wednesday. They are playing, they are playing Chile. Chile, who saw off Mexico in a, what can only be said is a humiliating 7-0 loss, Mexico. And of course, Mexico being coached by the Colombian Juan Carlos Osorio, who was very successful at Atlético Nacional. But that's neither here nor there. The real stories that are going on is that back in Havana, the representatives of the FARC Secretariat there and the Colombian government are into the final rounds of talks. We expect, I've heard this on the inside, but I can't say from whom. I've heard this on the inside that the peace dialogues are coming along very well, and expect some announcements before the end of June. I realize we're mid June now, but expect some announcements by the middle of June, at the end of June. Sorry. But take all of this into account when we're talking to Miguel Samper Strauss, the director of the National Land Agency here in Colombia. Take it into account when we're talking to him about the importance of land, the importance of justice, transitional justice, and beyond, because this is an exclusive interview, a one-off. This is the first interview that Miguel Samper Strauss has given with any media outlet since being promoted to this position of as director. And now this is really important because land is one of the key issues in Colombia, one of the issues that needs to be resolved. And so he is at the front of all of these debates and dialogues. And I'm sure that those in Havana are also conferring with him about some of the situations, about potential agrarian reforms that need to be enacted in order to have a more egalitarian Colombia. So very interesting indeed. I'm going to sign off right now just for a few minutes, and we'll be back with Miguel Samper Strauss in this episode 144. I'm Richard McColl. This is Colombia Calling. Please don't go away, and thank you for listening. And we're back. This is Colombia Calling. I'm Richard McColl, and we're here in Bogota, Colombia, 2,600 meters closer to the stars. I'm here with Miguel Samper, who is the former Vice Minister for Restorative Justice and the General Director of the National Land Agency. And we're going to do a serious show this week, episode 144, to talk about some of the situations that are ongoing in Colombia and tend to be a flashpoint regarding some of the issues around the peace dialogues and around, let's say, you know, what has always been fundamental problems in Colombia, the land. So Miguel, thank you for coming on the show and having me here in your office.
It's a pleasure for me to say hello to you, Richard, and for everyone that is listening to this program right now.
You're very welcome. Now, we're here today. The real story is we're not looking for scandal, and we're not looking to solve the crisis or anything else. What we're looking for here, myself, Richard McColl, the journalist, and hopefully the listeners of Colombia Calling, is just to learn a bit more about what has been going on in Colombia. And these are serious, serious issues, but you come with a great deal of experience. And maybe you could tell us a little bit about your past and what you're doing now.
Well, I was appointed in maybe 2010 as a transitional justice director in the Ministry of Justice. Well, back then it was the Ministry of Justice and Interior, the Ministry of the Policy of the Politics was joined with the Ministry of Justice. I don't know why, but that was the way it was. So, when I was appointed by the in that time, the minister was Mr. Vargas Lleras, who right now is vice president. He told me that he needed someone with some knowledge in transitional justice issues because he needed to draft a bill or a bill drafted on reparation for victims of the armed conflict.
Yes.
Before in the previous government, in President Uribe's government, a bill like that for the reparation of victims was tried to pass by Congress. It was a the initiative came from the Congress, from the Liberal Party.
Yes.
But in the last minute, in the last debate in the Senate, the government pressed really hard to exclude from the law, to exclude from reparation victims of the armed forces, of the official members, like
so soldiers and
public servants and everyone that worked for the government, were the military or it didn't matter. So the Liberal Party decided to, well, we here say hundir, which means literally to sunk the law in the Congress. So they stopped the legislative procedures of that law, and the law was dead. So President Santos, when he got to office, he said to his minister, to Mr. Vargas Lleras, I need a victim's law that it will include the victims of the armed forces and the public servants' victims. So that was my first assignment as Transitional Justice Director.
That's a big assignment, but of course it makes you very popular with the armed forces, very popular. But of course there are victims too. There are, like you said, the civil servants and politicians and soldiers are all victims. We've got every level of Colombian society has had victims. I mean, that's the truth. So you managed to get that law up and into play.
Right, and I think that the armed forces had their concerns. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you recognize that someone is victim of an official for the armed forces, then that they were going to be convicted for that crime, even though that this wasn't a criminal procedure. Mm-hmm. This was an administrative procedure, and if someone said to the government, I think that I'm a victim of the armed conflict, with that simple statement, the government should include that person in a list, mm-hmm. She would, be able to access to reparation in terms of economic reparation, land restitution. Mm-hmm. So the armed forces had those legitimate concerns, mm-hmm. but I think that in the first bill, in the first draft of the bill that we passed through Congress, those concerns were very, very tackled, because we managed to say to them in the bill, you're not going to be convicted, mm-hmm. and this is nothing that has nothing to do with your liability in terms of criminal procedures. Mm-hmm. And the armed forces at the end, they saw that the benefits of the law were bigger than the losses that they were, maybe in terms of reputation. Yeah. If they supported the law, as they did at the end, that they were going to get more gains in terms of reputation.
Yes. Well, I've seen a couple of months ago, I went on an academic trip down to La Macarena, but not to the Caño Cristales, but to spend time on the base and talk to generals and talk to colonels and captains. And I've seen since, in the 10 years that I've been living here, and since 1998, since I've been coming to Colombia, a real change in the attitude of the armed forces, have to say, and we talked about this, the reality of a peace agreement with the FARC. We didn't address the ELN, but we talked about this, and we talked about the legal implications of the victims' laws and reparation. And they, the high-ranking soldiers were all in favor, and even the low-ranking soldiers. And that was really refreshing to see. There seems to have been a great deal of work in educating and informing the armed forces about what is coming and what we need to do together as a country. So I imagine you are pretty much in that involved.
Well, for that aspect of the law, yes, I was at that time. But when the peace dialogues started with the FARC, that was a couple of years after the law, the victims' reparation law, was enacted. Mm-hmm. So yeah, a couple of years after that, the peace talk started, and a lot of assumptions, political assumptions, were being made in the public opinion. So I think that they saw some concerns at the beginning, but then the government started to talk to the generals and to talk to the armed forces, because one of the arguments, and I think that those arguments were completely unsupported, was trying to say that the government was going to give an equal treatment to the guerrilla members and to the members of the armed forces, and that is completely false. You're only going to be to give equal treatment to criminals. So if you belong to an armed force, to a legal armed force, and if you committed a crime, then you're going to receive the same treatment as every single one of the guerrilla members, because every single one of the guerrilla group members are criminals. They are criminals. So yeah, criminals are going to be treated equal, but not the people that uphold and defend the you know, rule of law and the legality of the state.
So basically, if you've done something wrong, you'll be brought to justice for it, whether you're a soldier or a guerrilla.
I mean, exactly.
This is the thing, and this is important. This is you know, obviously the way forward in these things. Right. Now, I know that, so you've been working a lot of this in the transitional justice. I know a fair bit about transitional justice. I'm fairly sure that a lot of my listeners are aware of it because it's a phrase that's used a lot. Uh-huh. But if I just share with the listeners out there, you know, the sort of four main points will be criminal prosecutions, reparation of the victims, institutional reform, and a sort of a truth commission. Have I missed anything out there for transitional justice?
No, but you're talking about the institutions that are going to carry out the transitional justice process.
Okay.
If I could refer to that as more as concepts, then you could say that is, yeah, those aspects that you mentioned as you need justice,
yeah.
You need truth,
yeah.
And you need reparations, and you need institutional reforms,
yes,
as well. So if you have those four components, then you have a transitional process going on.
Mm-hmm.
If one of them is missing, then you have a limp process that is going to fall down at any moment. And the peace that you're going to reach after you know, getting to the agreement is going to be a very weak peace,
mm-hmm,
and is going to be torn apart in some point of time, and the conflict is going to start again.
It's, yeah, very easy to undermine if you don't get everything right at the beginning, I guess is what you're saying. And this is really interesting because, you know, the opponents to transitional justice seem to think that there will be no criminal prosecutions. They seem to think that everyone's just going to be let off and Colombia will continue. But there will be criminal prosecutions, right? You tell me.
Well, yes, of course there's going to be criminal prosecutions. I mean, what the opposition to the peace process, or more to the government, is trying to state is that there's no peace without... They don't want peace with impunity.
Uh-huh.
The thing is that there's no other peace. I mean, there's no peace with impunity. So that's a false statement, and I think that they're trying to you know, confuse the public opinion.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are going to be criminal trials. The thing is that in order to be criminal trials hold after a peace process, a peace agreement is reached, the discussion is, whereas, how are you going to punish the criminals that are going to be guilty,
yeah,
after that criminal process? And that's a huge discussion, not only in transitional justice matters, but in criminal policy matters.
Mm-hmm.
The effectiveness of jail to redeem criminals go there and they learn how to be better criminals. So the effectiveness of jail to transform individuals into becoming active parts of society once they have served the time, then that is very undermined right now. And people, criminal policy makers are starting to think in other ways of punishing people because there are more effective ways in which they are going to become better citizens once they go out of jail.
So what is going to happen then? So it's not jail time, but there are alternative measures. And this is one of the big problems for, let's say, the opposition. Is are these alternative measures they're going to... What are we expecting the demobilized guerrillas to face?
Well, they can face one of three options.
Okay.
I picture that as three different doors.
Yeah.
You know, those big contests, TV contests, where they can pick one of three options.
Yeah.
Yeah. The first option is you have to tell the whole truth at the beginning of the process.
Yes.
So if we start and we say, well, right now is the starting point for you to tell us the truth, and you go out and you tell everything you know at the beginning, then you will not receive any punishment in jail time.
Okay.
If you start to think about it and you have your doubts, and then once you've thought about it, or someone just talk about your crimes or whatever, after in a second stage, you are willing to tell the truth, but you go out and you say to the government, "I want to tell the truth," then you will serve a time in jail of between 5 and 8 years.
It's a significant amount of time.
Yeah. But if you don't go and say to the government in a third phase, that's the third door, at any time, at any given time that you want to tell the truth, but the government cuts you, the government knows about your crimes and convicts you, then you're going to serve jail time for 20 years. Okay. I mean, we have two doors here, 2 out of 3, where you have the result is jail time. So yeah, there's going to be punishment. And in the first jail punishment, in the first door, there's also going to be a different kind of punishment. Mm-hmm. You're going to be, your liberty is going to be restricted because you are not going to be able to move from a determined area of the country.
Yeah.
And also you're going to have to, render social service and help build a school that you once blew up. Or yeah, there are going to be different types of punishment for the first door.
But proper, but these are, we say punishment. This is putting back into the community. This is, reconstructing infrastructure. This is helping rebuild a society.
So, exactly.
And these guys probably have good skills in that. I've seen some of the stuff they built. they're still standing. The bridges in the Macarena and so on. It sounds fair. And like you say, this is a negotiation, and concessions need to be made on both sides. This guerrilla group agreed to come to the table to negotiate. It was a big deal since November 2012. Now, yeah,
right.
It's a big deal. Colombia, how many years of bloodshed and has there been? It's been nonstop, really. But we think about 1964 as the principal date. When people are in opposition, yeah, the word impunity always comes in, and then they talk about guerrillas getting a minimum wage of 2 million pesos or 1,800,000. This isn't true. So how can we help spread the word about what is going to happen? Because without criticizing the President Santos too much, I just feel that his government has not been out there educating the people. Don't get yourself in trouble. Don't get yourself in trouble. But what is it we can do to help?
Well, I think that these kind of interviews and everything we can do to share the voices is very helpful. I resigned from the Vice Minister of Justice last year, and I had a period of time when I was writing a book about transitional justice. Well, it was more like a publication. Made by the International Migrations Office organization, right? But then I started making these videos. They were animated videos, very homemade. I mean, I'm a lawyer, so imagine those home videos. How can they be? And the first video, well, I wrote a couple of columns in the El Tiempo.
Yes.
And online, they reached approximately 2,500 people. But those videos, they have reached already 60,000 people. It's amazing how people are eager for information. They are very short. They are 2 minutes long. They are very easy to watch. But I think that we have to convey the message in the way that people want that message conveyed. And we haven't reached that point yet from the government perspective. And I include myself now because I'm right now running the land agency.
Well, excellent. Well, I'll take a look out for these cartoons. And this is the way of getting through to the YouTube generation, isn't it?
Exactly.
Short, informed bursts of information.
In a very, very deconstructed language, because that's the way that people should understand and how you should explain to people.
Perfect. Yeah. Perfect. We're going to take a short break, and we'll be back to continue talking in the same vein about justice and the realities in Colombia. We're talking to Miguel Samper, who is the former Vice Minister for Restorative Justice and the General Director presently of the National Land Agency. This is Columbia Calling, episode 144. I'm Richard McCall, and we're going to take a short break. We'll be right back. Thank you for listening. And we're back. This is Columbia Calling. I'm Richard McCall, episode 144, with Miguel Samper, the former Vice Minister for Restorative Justice and now the General Director of the National Land Agency, where we are right now. Now, the issue of land in Colombia is about the most important issue, in my opinion. You know, I'm
no
an
doubt.
Academic.
No doubt.
I'm an academic, and every time we study anything about the conflict, anything about the reality of Colombia, it comes back to land. Not only land ownership, it's access to land, access to communication. And so there's this really spiritual connection, I think, not only with, let's say, the indigenous people of Colombia, but also the colonos, so the colonial people, you know, even the Creole people, even the new immigrants. Land is the key thing, and there's never really been a major land reform here in Colombia. While all other Latin American countries, well, by no, let's say South American countries, have had them. One of the last was like Peru, and they worked out how to do it by giving each of the soldiers a piece of land. So therefore, they knew that they were fighting for the very soil upon which they were treading. There was a sense of belonging. But here in Colombia, it seems very difficult. And you must be in the hot seat here at the director of the National Land Agency. How do you address such, like, you know, something like I said just now, you know, this spirituality to the land? Because it's not something very bureaucratic. It doesn't sound like it should be said in an office, but it's really true here, right?
Right. Well, that same question asked my wife asked me that yes. same question last week. Yeah, well, because as vice minister, I was in charge of handling and managing the jails, jail system, the prison system of the country. So my wife asked me, listen, you must be crazy. You from jails to land. I mean, I prefer jails even.
Jails aren't great.
I know. And in the general jail institution, there are like 67 unions over there. Yeah, it's a big thing to handle. But anyways, yeah, we've been killing each other for 200 years now. Yeah. And everything is because of the land.
Yeah.
Everything is because we don't have clear knowledge of whose land, the property rights are very confused. We don't have a good registration of the land ownership. We don't have good registers. We don't have good offices for that. And even during the armed conflict stage from the 60s till now, the armed groups, the guerrilla groups, the paramilitary groups, the new Bakrim groups, everyone was behind the land. Mm-hmm. The land was the key factor to get into conflict, and I think it's going to be the key factor to get out of the conflict if we want to have a sound and very, you know, durable peace. Mm-hmm. So well, this is a hot seat, but it's a new one. Mm-hmm. The land agency is a new agency. We had previous to this, we have the INCODER. Mm-hmm. So this is part of the institutional reform that the government started to make in order to face the post-conflict stage. Mm-hmm. And I think that you have to focus on, there are so many tasks and so many challenges that I'm going to focus the President Santos want me here in three things, the three main things. We have to grant access to land to those peasants or workers of the rural areas that don't have any land or that they have too little to survive.
Yes.
The second thing that we have to face is that if, like happens here, like more than 60% of the land owners, they don't have a title. They don't have legalized their titles, so they are not really in terms of the law. They are not the owners of the land, but they are in possession of the land.
Sure.
So we have to legalize those titles, and we have to formalize that land ownership. Mm-hmm. And the third thing is that if you have land and you have the land already formalized with a legal title, then we should make sure that you are going to use it for the social purpose that land should be used for. We have a very high principle. It's a constitutional article that says that if you have, if you own something here, you have to use it in a way that doesn't affect society.
Okay.
And if you don't grow anything in the land that you own, it's because, well, it's a presumption, but it's because you want to speculate with the price of the land or anything, but or you just wanted the land to be there sitting with without any production, and those things the government should punish, because we have to give the land to someone that really wants to produce on that land. So yeah, I think those are the three main objectives that we're going to work for here.
I don't know where you start, because there are such huge areas of land here. I mean, if we think about the departments like Finchala, Meta, Wainia, all of these areas that are, let's say, savanna or jungle, and have no communication really. How do we know who owns them? I mean, this is the thing. Your office, your institute is investigating all of this.
Right.
You're investigating who has been working the land, who perhaps owns it. But this puts you in a dangerous situation if you start coming up against maybe some other, let's say, entities who want the land and feel that you might take it from them. This is a risky job.
Yeah, I think that every job that involves something with the conflict, with the armed conflict, is going to be a risky one.
Okay.
But someone has to start it, and someone has to do it, right? It's like
that's very brave of you. That's very blasé as well. You're quite, as we say here, you're fresco. Someone has to do it. But I mean, there must be, I just keep thinking of this one very Colombian description about this. He's like, que chicharrón, no? I can just imagine the paperwork, because I suppose if you're in, let's say, if you're in Guaviare or in El Retorno, somewhere around there, which is a particularly hard hit area, and I mean, I guess you have to send agents down to go into the local bureaucratic offices, maybe I guess it's the alcaldía, to try and find paperwork that might register something. But how likely is it that there is paperwork existing in El Retorno, for example?
Well, I think that there are some regions that we don't have any history, any records of any kind of the ownership. But in the most productive areas of the country, like in Cauca, like in the north, or like in the Magdalena Medio or something like that, then you're going to have registers, because land there has been at dispute, in constant dispute, and is in constant conflict. But yeah, those far-reaching areas of the east part of the country, those areas we have to do pursue. We have to work differently.
Yeah.
Historically, the way that the institution of Incoder, the Incoder worked, was that they were waiting in the offices, in the regional offices, for someone to say, this land is mine.
Uh-huh.
Now we can go and we're not going to work, we're still going to work on demand, but we're going to offer also. We're going to work in a scheme that is going to also offer and go to the territories, and is going to swipe down the whole territory. Is one of our main functions, one of our main tasks. Swipe the territory to see who owns it, and if you've been there for 20 years and you don't have a title, then we'll give you one. And after that swipe is going to be made, the idea in a post-conflict stage is that the development agencies, the infrastructure agency, healthcare, justice, everything comes behind the land ownership or securement in order for the rural development to work. And if we want to stop illicit crops cultivation, if we want to stop the armed conflict as a whole, then we should really think how to intervene the rural areas of the country in a very comprehensive strategy, in a very integral strategy.
I mean, it just sounds, it's such a big job, to go. I know, and like you said, those areas in the Far East, it's a different story. It's like you'll be creating the first ever history of those areas because it's unknown. Yes, obviously, Magdalena Medio and other parts which have always been more industrial, let's say, or more worked, ganadería and other things, and mining. Yeah, I'm sure there's paperwork to say. But do you have an idea in your head how long it will take to do the whole country?
Well, to swipe the whole country, yeah. I think that if we have the budget, of course, it's going to last for 4 years. The project is to make it in 4 years.
That's fast.
Yeah, yeah.
But it has to be fast because we're going into the post-accord, post-conflict stage.
Exactly. But it's going to be very costly. We're estimating that this strategy is going to cost 2.6 billion pesos. Which is approximately $1 billion, something like that. So it's a lot of money.
A lot of money that the government, I don't think, has right now.
Well, we're going to...
You're going to get it.
Yeah, we're going to go to the international banks to see if they're going to lend us some money. But if we don't start with that financially muscle, mm-hmm. Then we're not going to end this task at any time. Yeah. I mean, we can spend $200,000 a year, but then we're going to last for 99 years to know whose land is it. And that's one of the things that amazed me the most when I got here. Mm-hmm. Is how is it possible that, we have something here that is called baldíos. I don't know how to say it in English, but
is it state land? Or?
Yeah, it's land that no one's owns, exactly. That no one owns, so it belongs to the state. Mm-hmm. But the state doesn't know what land is that, what baldíos are there out there. We only know a very small portion of it, but we don't know, because the rule was that if no one owns it, then it's of the state.
Okay.
But the state doesn't have a title of that land. So is that just a general presumption that in a negative way, if no one owns it, then it's yours. But we should have an inventory of this, right?
It's very difficult, isn't it? Because that was one of the key problems I saw in La Macarena as well. The baldíos and then you've got baldíos and you've got titled areas and then you've got... Comunidad Campestres, I can't remember. There's all sorts, and it was so mixed up, and these are very aggressive unions, who are out there and trying to claim the land. And fair enough, everybody wants their piece of land. So we've been talking of the big picture of Colombia. If we take a little, if we try and focus it, so there are many people out there who know that the government is trying to do this, trying to legalize the documentation of who owns the land. And I know for a fact in the town of, or near to the town of Morales, I think it's in Bolivar, just across the Magdalena River from Cesar, mm-hmm. is where, there are all sorts of campesinos who own land, but they're going up and they're now putting up their own little houses on other pieces of land so that when the government arrives, it's like, well, no, this is mine. So how do you get around this? Because I know it's a small problem, but it's a problem because it will repeat for years and years and years.
Oh, it's a big problem.
Okay.
And we've heard in Cauca, for example, we've just been there, and we've heard from landowners that if they don't want to sell to the indigenous people their land, then they will invade their land and stay there. 200 families of indigenous people there and stay there and until the state comes and buy the land from the owner and gives them back to the indigenous people. Yeah, but those are some examples, and I think that we should put in place some measures to, safe keep. And the law 160 mm-hmm. has put in place some mechanisms that if you don't live there and you don't prove that you have some relation to the land that comes with a history, then the state cannot give that land to you.
Okay.
And I think that policy of buying land and giving them to indigenous communities or Afro-Colombian communities or to even peasant communities, That's not a sustainable policy. Mm-hmm. State shouldn't be buying land from anyone. Mm-hmm. State should be doing that stripe to identify the land, to legalize the titles that people don't have at the moment, and to start from zero, from scratch, and say, okay, now this is in the new way that land ownership is going to be understood in the country, and I'm not going to buy a single piece of land from anyone, so stop invading other people, other people's land.
I can understand. Yeah, I can understand. It's tough. You mentioned Cauca, and this is, we'll come back to Cauca because we'll talk a little bit about the blockades,
right,
and agri, because we need to. Because, you know, I'm in this office, I have to. But I was thinking a little bit about Well, something is coming up in the news a lot, and because you are the general director of the National Land Agency. How much truth is there behind the theory that the FARC, or you know, some of the top leaders of the FARC, like let's say Marulanda, obviously who's died, and Monohohoi, did they own really big pieces of land as well? Did they actually legalize ownership of land?
Yes. And we found, the previous institution in Coder found that they could expropriate, that they could take away land in the order of 3,100 hectares.
300,000 hectares.
Right. From then, and I think that right now we have those pieces of land right now here at the National Land Agency for us to make a rural reform. So yes, they did own that so kind
of, even in revolutionary thought, the land ownership, it's a thing.
Yeah.
Okay.
As I told you, I mean, our armed conflict, Marulanda always said that our land conflict started because of some chicken and some pigs.
Yeah, that's right.
But I think that in reality he was referring to that piece of land where the chicken and the pigs were.
Si nos permiti, si solamente nos permitía alimentar las gallinitas y los cerditos.
Exactly.
Yeah, a very famous quote from that one. But then, right, you know, that's really, that. I mean, that whole area, when you think of Biota and all of that area and Marquetalia, I mean, that's, still today, troublesome. But let's talk about Cauca, because you've just come back from Cauca, where you've been negotiating to stop these, agricultural blockades, or you've been negotiating with the indigenous blockades.
They were two factions.
Yes.
Last week there were two factions. One of the factions was completely indigenous people,
yes,
of the Cauca region. And they were blockading for everything. One of the 12 points of their demands was agriculture, and in that point was the land issue, because government the government has a big debt with the indigenous communities in Cauca, not only because it is a historical debt with them, because at the beginning of the 20th century, the indigenous communities were displaced,
yeah,
by the big landowners in Cauca and everything, but also because in the last decade, government has compromised and has made agreements with them in order to give them land.
Mm-hmm.
So right now we own them. We owe them
yeah.
30,000 hectares,
yeah,
and 40,000 million pesos in land.
Uh-huh.
That we have to buy.
That's
only for them.
Because of the last government.
Exactly. Because government of Santos number one. Yeah.
Okay, Santos first of the two.
First government, yeah.
2010 to 2014.
Yeah.
So he made those agreements.
With them.
But they have not been fulfilled yet.
Exactly.
And so that's
exactly
why they're out there on the, blockading the Pan American Highway.
One of the main reasons, but they have many more.
Yes.
Like, they don't want any more mining concessions to be granted there. They don't want, they want the environmental licenses to be more difficult to get from if they are going to be in Cauca. Yeah, they had a lot of demands. One of the main demands in the agricultural point was this, the land that we owe them.
Yeah.
And we also had to negotiate with what is called La Cumbre Agraria.
Yes.
But
it's like an umbrella term for all of the different unions.
Yes, yeah. all the agricultural unions. Yes. There you can find also indigenous people, mm-hmm. also indigenous communities. Actually, the National Organization of Indigenous People is there in the Cumbre Agraria, mm-hmm. not only for Cauca, but is there. And also the Afro-Colombian communities are there, and also the peasant communities, okay. the peasant unions are yes. there. So we had to negotiate with the three kinds of populations, and they all had these different land demands. The biggest one was the one of the peasants, mm-hmm. because they think that they haven't been treated accordingly by the government. And they all demanded that the government should buy, the peasants demanded that the government should buy 4 million hectares and give those hectares back to the peasants. Mm-hmm. 4 million hectares. I mean, that's a small department here in, yeah, in Colombia.
Like Risaraldo or something.
Yeah, something like that. So it's huge demand.
How do you see it? I mean, because Cauca has always been a problem department.
I mean, right.
It's strategic.
Right.
For every group, and it's been strategic for you know, and it's very productive, it's very fertile. But how do you see a solution to this? I mean, you're here, you have to have something in your mind.
Well, I think that we should start building trust. That's the first thing that we should start bringing those communities here to policy making before the social conflicts start exacerbating again.
Yeah.
So we have to involve them, and we have to create mechanisms of fast participation, because the only way in which government historically listens to these communities is when they go out and blockade a big highway like the Panamericana or something. So we should, before that happens, we should involve them, make them participate directly in the policy making process, and they can see from here that from our perspective, Cauca is a very important department, but it's one of out of 32.
Yeah.
So we have to put attention to other departments. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that that the Cumbre Agraria only focused on Cauca, because Cumbre Agraria was focusing on everything
Everywhere. Nationwide.
Uh-huh. But they took advantage in political terms. Of the, because over there, the northern part of the Cauca is ruled by an indigenous community that is a very, confrontational one. And they took advantage of that. So we had to negotiate with indigenous communities from the south part of the Cauca separately, and in the Cumbre Agraria with the northern indigenous communities of the Cauca. So yeah.
It's too complex.
It's very complex.
It's too complex.
And I've been only here for 2 weeks. So.
But 2 weeks. first interview. Tell me.
Yes, the first interview. So that's an exclusive. Right?
This is an exclusive. Yeah, I didn't know that. But this is—it's so complex. All of these things. It's so difficult. But I just keep thinking. You know, are we going to expect more blockades in the coming months?
No, I hope not.
Because holidays are coming up, you know. Everybody wants to get in their car and drive around. I don't want to trivialize this, but this is the truth. It's that they know they can block the roads. They know they can block the roads. It doesn't take any effort at all. You cut down a tree and you block the road. Have you heard that there are any plans for a march on Bogota or anything like that?
No. At the moment,
we're now calm. Now,
yeah.
Okay.
Last Sunday, when we reached an agreement, then they were very happy, because I think that we made some important agreements, and now we have to fulfill them. And these agreements are going to be fulfilled for the next 6 months in my case, or for the next year in some other cases, like the Ministry of Interior. So I think that right now we have to fulfill all the promises that we made and all the agreements that we reach over there. And I hope that if government starts fulfilling those yes. agreements, then we're not going to have any more problems.
Okay.
But the thing is that it's not sustainable to have money from the perspective of land. It's not sustainable for the government to have money and to buy land and give it to the protesters mm-hmm. and you know. we have to make public policy sustainable and long-term public policy in terms of land reform.
Yeah.
So I'm going to get them and call them and get them involved from the beginning of this policy-making process. I hope that this way the social tensions that are now arising, and they are completely normal when you're in a peace dialogue process, then these social tensions are going to be diminished or at least handled.
It's a confidence thing, isn't there? The social tensions, the confidence. And as you say, I can fully agree with that. The government can't just go handing out money. It is, because that will never end. It will never end. It will be a policy from here forever.
Exactly.
So I don't envy your job, I have to say. you've been, well, you know, justice and restorative.
Well, maybe we can next week change and we'll interview you. And
yeah, you can interview me about being a parent. You're a parent too, so you know all about it.
Yeah.
Well, listen, let me take this moment to say thank you very much to you for taking this time and being incredibly open about the topics here in Colombia. It's been really informative, and that's the aim of this radio show, this podcast. So hopefully, I mean, we're informing people out there a little bit more than what they would read in the national or international press. So thank you, Miguel Samper, the general director of the National Land Agency, for your time and for your insights.
Well, thank you very much. I enjoyed really much this exclusive interview and the first one.
Well, this has been episode 144. I hope you've enjoyed it. Of course, if you want to get in touch, that's columbiacalling@gmail.com. We're on Facebook, we're on Twitter, and you can get in touch anyway. This way, if you want to perhaps identify people to be interviewed or themes that you prefer to hear about. Thank you for listening, and goodbye.